Welcome. This is the UX Design Cast podcast series, and my name is Carl Vredenberg. This is the monthly panel discussion format that we have in this overall series, and I'm delighted to have with me on the session today, Elian Tozman, who's with the Media Design Studio in Toronto, Canada. Welcome, Elian.
Hi, Carl.
And we also have Keith Enstone, who is our information architecture lead for IBM.com. Welcome, Keith.
Hi. Great to be here again.
Well, that's great. And we don't have with us today Val Fox. She wasn't available for the recording this month. She will be returning again next month. And we also will have a few others as well from a variety of other companies as well joining us on this particular panel session as we go over and review the design-related news and happenings over the past month. And so we've got some, I think, exciting things that we are going to be talking about here. And just so that you also know, we record the things we're lining up to discuss in this session in Delicious, and we use the UX Design Cast tag for the things that we're considering putting into the discussion for that month's session. So if you wanted to have a look, you can also have a look directly in Delicious for that as well. So I wanted to start off the discussion this month on a blog post that I wrote a little while ago that I titled Designing for the Cloud. I did some reflection on my use of a variety of capabilities and tools and systems that are so-called in the cloud, which fundamentally means that the data that you're dealing with is not on your local machine, but is on a central server somewhere. And it is typically shown when people talk about this, when they're designing systems, they sort of describe and draw a little cloud up there on the whiteboard, and that cloud, you know, refers to where the data reside. And that term also has been now used to refer to this overall sort of architecture of dealing with applications largely running in the browser, but having their data centrally located somewhere on a server that users typically have no idea where they even, you know, reside. So I was reflecting on my use of the browser-based applications that have their data in the cloud. And I was thinking about, you know, some of the challenges and criticisms that people have, you know, leveled at, you know, these types of applications. And one, you know, recently, or some pundits talk about, oh, well, the overall availability, the overall speed, and then some have talked about the design as well. And I was reflecting on sort of the availability of these, and over the past month, there was also an outage at Google for its Gmail servers for some time. And there was a lot of talk about, oh, you know, I don't know about this cloud computing because, hey, you know, that system, you know, was down for a bit. But I reflected on that. I think that my power to my home has sort of gone off many, many, many more times. And I don't think I'm unusual in that regard compared to the overall reliability of these kinds of cloud services, you know, like the one that I was referring to in terms of Gmail. You know, it's almost always, I mean, it's always there. I reliably, you know, assume that it's there. I may, you know, not have power to get to it or have the access to it for other reasons at times in terms of having a, you know, Wi-Fi connection or whatever. But fundamentally, the service is there. And so I just wanted to sort of debunk that overall concern regarding availability. Speed, I've also been, you know, especially the cloud-based applications that I use that are from larger vendors are, you know, at least as fast, if not faster, than a lot of the capabilities that are, you know, right on the desktop. But I did want to draw your attention to or raise here for discussion that I do think that there are a bunch of challenges in a number of the applications that we use every day that are sort of cloud-based in their actual design. And I pointed out a number of issues that I saw with the design of these kinds of systems that are not aligned with, for example, common user interface design patterns. And also things like a required, I think, you know, autosave capability. I've had a number of instances when I've been writing some stuff, you know, whether it's in Facebook, whether it's in, I know I use the Podbean system for these podcasts. And if you don't actually, you know, remember to save, and if something goes awry, and especially if it goes awry because you're, you know, clicking on something that is not intuitive in terms of the interface, you know, you lose all those data, and there's no way to get it, you know, get it back unless you have this autosave. And so other systems like, you know, Gmail itself, you know, has that autosave as well. So I wanted to start off and talk about that. You know, this is really the future, I think, for computing, that you have your data reliably somewhere on a server. You can access from anywhere. All you need is a browser. And the capabilities of having huge functionality that normally we have on our desktop, we're increasingly getting in the browser. And so I think this is truly the way forward, and I'm a real fan. And so I wanted to get us started on that topic first. Now, Ellie and Keith, any thoughts, comments on what I've been saying?
I think it's true. I think a lot of what you're saying is true, but I think what comes to mind, at least for me, is when you talk about the application Facebook, I think it wasn't designed with user interest in mind. It was designed to bring, you know, to bring together all these university students at Harvard, right? And it was very much a viral kind of thing that happened, and there was not much thought beyond the very surface of it. And then they started adding, you know, many more capabilities, and they never really thought about how to make it more user friendly, not in depth as, let's say, Gmail, who really does think about those things. Podbean, I don't know that well, so I can't talk about it. But definitely something like Facebook, I don't think they really put a lot of thought into it. And I think that if more of these types of cloud type applications that come about without so much thought, you know, you're going to run into a huge problem where you're going to have much, you know, it's going to be very messy, so to speak.
Yeah, Carl, it kind of reminds me of some of the good old days. I'm thinking back to when the Macintosh Human Interface Guidelines came out, right? They weren't just guidelines on how to design user interface, but it was around functions too, right? If you want to build an application for the Mac, you have to have an undo function, okay? Well, I think we're going to have to start to see a list of, here's the basic features that are expected for an application that runs in the cloud, things like autosave, and I don't think there'll be, you know, we won't have baked in standards because it's not one vendor, but we will start to get some best practices. Those applications that have autosave and these other expected features will survive, and the ones that don't will quickly adopt or go away. But that it's sort of, again, all these new things always, I guess I'm getting old, because I start thinking back to old days where, yeah, it's just an updated version of sort of that period, a previous period, in our technology evolution, where we have a lot of new things coming out, and we need to get some of the basic things right, like basic functionality that works all the time. Right. I am impressed that, like, right, the net doesn't go down very much, and you know, for me, the early fear was I can't use Gmail because I don't have a local copy on my hard drive and so on. But I think folks are seeing that all that technology is stable enough, so the time is right to make the leap.
I wonder actually if there's a lower level, a lower sort of a threshold for people really liking some of these applications. I think we may have talked about last time too, that there seems to be such an amazing draw toward, you know, person-to-person communications, like using, you know, Facebook or Twitter for that matter, and even things like Gmail. All these things are free, right? All these things are provide a mechanism for, you know, directly connecting a lot of, you know, people together. And I wonder whether there people are just more forgiving of, you know, design problems when they can still, you know, glean the benefits of being able to link directly to, you know, other people as well. And so I wonder, as these systems mature even further, whether we would, you know, get even better, you know, user interface design in some of these systems? Because, you know, everybody sort of roundly, you know, criticizes and resoundingly criticizes the design of like Facebook, even though I think they've done a reasonably good job of redesigning at least once of the overall system. But there are still some pretty strange things that happen there. But even Gmail has some pretty strange things, even for, you know, UI design patterns for doing things like email. Some pretty good ideas in there too. But I'm just wondering whether the difference with the past that you're talking about, Keith, is that those were products and these aren't quite products. And I wonder if there's a different level of expectation that users have for, you know, these kinds of UIs.
But the thing is, we also have to be careful. It's not, it's free, yes, but there's certain, we have to still pay for, you know, for access to it, right? And in countries, like in a lot of, there's an article that I read, a lot of developing countries don't have access to all this great technology and all these great free tools, right, so to speak. That's just something to keep in mind, like, you know, it's not, but it's just something to be aware of, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Keith, you were going to say?
Yeah, and I think you hit it, Carl, of thinking of these more as services than applications. And so trying to approach this as, you know, what are some common services that you need so that your service fits in with other services? You know, less of having products. Products just feel so siloed nowadays, I guess. But if we think of these as services, that's usually how they describe the, you know, one of the prototypical cloud software as a service. So if we start thinking of these of how would we design a service, then I think that both fits the new model. I think it ties into the human aspect, right? Because, you know, in the real world, we think of services as things that we do with other people. And so I think that ties in as well, the social aspect. So
yeah, it's a new way of communicating, right? It's a new way of... It's not the software per se. We're entering a whole new realm of services, and we're moving away from the whole idea of buying your software, installing it, so on and so forth.
Now, it also strikes me that a lot of the things we're seeing are still fairly basic, right? And so the cloud-based and services-based applications tend to still have fairly simple tasks that you carry out, fairly simple, you know, like we talked about the Gmail piece, the Facebook capability, to Twitter is probably the ultimate in simplicity of simply having 140 characters of text going back and forth. What's interesting is we had bookmarked to talk about as well some additional new capabilities that are being worked on, you know, at IBM in the Emerging Technology Group, a project called Blue Spruce, which has in the title of the piece that was in, you know, in the trade press, and at ReadWrite Web, talking about IBM's next generation browser platform. And this is a capability that really is taking the sort of the simplicity of only doing one thing at a time and in a very simple web interface to cloud-based data and enhancing it further with various multimedia capabilities as well, that you can start to collaborate. You can have, you know, video streams in there. You can mash up, you know, data content dynamically in working with people from various you know, parts of the world and the like, and all of this running in a fundamentally generic, you know, browser using like a WebKit engine that tends to be the, you know, heavily used open source browser engine currently. And I thought that was actually a really interesting new direction too. So, you know, going beyond the basics of some of the things that we've been talking about there that are fairly straightforward, but really getting into some amazing capability, but again, still in the browser. These are not desktop pieces. These are in standard, you know, publicly available open source, you know, browser technology. So I thought that was also an interesting direction of something that it also, I think we have a couple articles that we pointed to that had to do with that particular project that sounded pretty exciting. Any thoughts, comments, either one of you from those?
Well, what I really like about the idea of Blue Spruce is that it's a tool that's built for collaborative web browsing. So someone, and I think from what I was reading, it's meant to actually have people bring people together who are all over the world and kind of work together using, you know, your browser as a tool and, you know, being able to interact with information, push and pull for information, you know, and using all these different, you know, these different ways of getting that information, such as video, streamlining, you know, whatever it is, right? So I thought that was very, very interesting.
Yeah, I like the way how we're building upon the sort of the technology that we have now that in the past we've called a web browser, but it's really, you know, crossing it over into a platform. So again, I don't know at what point will we have to stop calling it a web browser, but that thing that we use for browsing the web, we shall call it, and then really just, you know, putting the pieces together, right? All of these open source pieces so that we can build these applications across the different platforms. So that's, I think that's one thing that's different here versus I think other attempts were a little bit more platform specific, right? So if IBM does it, it's one thing. If Microsoft does it, then we're kind of tied into the Microsoft platform or even some Adobe things. So that, I think we'll see over time how that plays out. This open source nature of it, does that really change the game and really make it so that you can put all the different pieces together? Because again, in the cloud, it's a fuzzy thing. You're not supposed to have to worry about all these technology things. That's like, hey, that video that you want to mush together with your map is on YouTube, and that's owned by Google, so you can't put it together with something that's, you know, being delivered with Silverlight from Microsoft, right? That's not what people want to worry about. They just want to be able to put all these pieces together and have their tool that they're using work across all of those.
Right. Yeah, and I was thinking too, the other characteristic that I really liked about this project, and it's also similar to some of the things, just the approach that people take to it, that's similar to what Google's been doing and the Google Labs, and also what Mozilla's been doing with their labs. You know, sort of an interesting open source approach, but is also one that is all about just building it, you know, designing it, building it, evolving it, and then further sort of extending it. And that seems to be, you know, we talked earlier in the podcast series about the application of agile methods and ways of optimizing the design within agile methods of development. And what's cool about these approaches, I think, is not only that they're open and will work anywhere, as you were saying, Keith, but it's also the case that they are being developed in an agile fashion so that you can immediately see what's going on and what the idea, you know, would be as you evolve. And, you know, you take it to a stage where it's also then publicly available, people can play with it and the like. And I think it's just an excellent model of moving forward. So I think this is one we're going to need to keep, you know, our tabs on and maybe refer to again as we hear more about that and are able to provide information to everybody that listens to this session. But I think it's one to, you know, track in terms of where it's going and in terms of IBM's model of the ways in which the browser, and as you say, the browser platform, Keith, will evolve in this open source way of driving, you know, significantly greater capability into the browser with data coming from the cloud.
Yep, and then I just sort of the other little trend that I'm noticing is that I think we have enough of the basics of the cloud done, so now people are focusing on the user experience, sort of the, aha, it actually works, right? I can actually read my email in the cloud. Okay. I've been doing it for a year now. That's fine. Now we've got to make it a really, you know, now we really have to make it a great experience. So that seems to be the newer trend that's coming along as well.
So I know that you guys also had bookmarked some things that have happened in the last month that we wanted to cover today. Maybe turn to you, Keith, if you want to take us to the next topic.
Sure. So yeah, we bookmarked the 10 harsh truths of corporate websites, which was posted earlier in February, had, what, 327 comments. So it was definitely a hot item for people to talk about. And you know, my general reaction was working for IBM for the past 8 years. Yeah, these are no-brainers. These are definitely important issues that you have to deal with in large corporations, right? How do you organize the work on your website around your org chart? Should it just be in a particular, you know, should it be in marketing or should it be in IT? And we could go into depth on the right way to do it. It's sort of like how we organize our user experience teams. Do you have a one central team or do you have things distributed? Well, you need some sort of matrix model to do all of it. So these are all very real world problems that you have, that large corporations have. But what also struck me was that, you know, this sort of feels like the old model anyway, right? We're spending all time thinking about the cloud, and this is focused on how to make your corporate website great. But more and more every day, you know, the companies actually have a bigger challenge, which is how to make their overall web presence, right? How do they worry about their ranking in Google, and how do they make the information that and the capabilities that they have available to their customers through the cloud, right? And so part of it says, yeah, these are really important issues, but part of it is like, I don't know, in 10 years, there's going to be a lot of companies that probably don't have to worry about this because they don't have much of a corporate website anymore, right? They're concentrating on serving their customers' needs through the cloud, through other places.
I thought that the 10 harsh truths were kind of interesting in some respects in terms of, you know, saying things like the one that was particularly relevant to some of the things that I've been doing, and that is this whole notion of, you know, the social networks and whether, you know, you should have a presence, whether there's a corporate presence for a company or of its constituent elements on things like Twitter, for example. And, you know, the advice is not to do that, you know, to just have all of your staff Twittering and contributing and connecting with, you know, customers and other colleagues and all that kind of stuff. And I thought that was actually not all that insightful a comment. I've been reading a lot about this myself lately. And the wisdom that I found out there is that, you know, companies should have a presence. In fact, in the Twitterverse, as it's now sort of being called, there's a lot of negativity when a company does not have any presence, you know, out there in Twitter. And when one shows up, it's sort of like, whoa, they arrived, you know. And, you know, Google just arrived, for example. But I think there's wisdom in doing it right, doing it wrong. And I think that there is a lot of benefit for having, you know, individual people from a company also, you know, being on things like Twitter and the social networking kind of sites. But to also have some identified presence as well for a company, but then very importantly, still to be interactive. And I've learned this in, you know, running the IBM Design Twitter account for the last while, you know, where, you know, if you are expected, I think, or people are expecting of those kinds of accounts to not only be there as a marketing vehicle, not only be there as a vehicle for, you know, communicating only things that have to do with, you know, the company that happens to have its name on the account, but instead to provide as the users or the other people on Twitter help me to also formulate that it should be a balance of providing insight, providing pointers to other interesting articles that don't necessarily have anything to do in our case with IBM, but also to then share experiences and sort of the insights that we glean from our company point of view as well. So I would think that there's a new place for an identity for a company in these social networks that is just evolving. I think everybody's just trying to figure this out. But I don't think that it should be a absolutely do not ever do anything, you know, representing your company. And I don't think that it's the opposite is true either. I don't think that you should be doing nothing but advertising and the like on there either. So I thought that was one in particular that I took issue with.
Yeah, and that's one of the problems with a top 10 list like this, right? You try to boil it down. The life isn't so black and white. There's a lot more beneath the surface when you really dig through it. And if you just want to make something, you know, that a lot of people read and comment on, then you pick one extreme and say that's the only way to go.
Right.
But you know what? It struck me too with this, and I got the point of the article, and I was like, yeah, they're just trying to point out certain things that, you know, you have to remember when you're working on a corporate website. But I got to the end, and I was kind of like, well, is there anything more? I don't think they were looking, and it was the purpose of the article. They weren't trying to push the envelope, saying, well, what about looking into new ways of, you know, talking about the cloud, right? And I thought that. I wanted to see that within that article, right? It's like, it's almost like I was reading and I'm like, yeah, okay, yes, you're right, you're right, you're right, you're right, you're right, or you're wrong, or yeah, it's a good point, but that was about it. It was nothing new, you know, nothing was new in there, right? It was just, oh yeah, it's true, oh yeah, you know, stuff like along those lines. So I thought that was kind of my take on this article, right? Although a lot of it spoke to me for sure, you know, as someone who does work in a web space, you know, like the whole idea of a pixel pusher, I was like, yeah, that's true.
Well, I also found, Elian, that there was a lot of good advice in there too. So I would highly recommend that people read it. But I think it's also the case that you look at various companies and what level of maturity they've actually, you know, gotten to. And I think there's probably lots to advise a lot of, you know, companies that may be lower on that maturity grid. But I think what I was looking for, and that's sort of what I was referring to in my comments a few minutes ago with regard to the social networking piece, is there wasn't a lot of good insight in terms of where all of this is going. You know, where,
exactly.
You know, yeah, it was entirely appropriate for the way that corporate websites, you know, have been over the last, you know, sort of 5, 10 years, you know, advice like that you should have a central team that does this, and it shouldn't just be somebody's part-time job, that it should also be, as you were saying, Keith, that it shouldn't reflect the structure of the company. It really should, you know, convey the products in a form that users would want it. I mean, a lot of that kind of stuff I think is really, really good, but a lot of companies, the larger companies, have addressed all of that. What I think is needed is, you know, some real thought as to, you know, where all this is going. You know, if you think of the trajectory of things like, you know, like I said, like Twitter, like Facebook and the like, that are just taking off like crazy in terms of eyeballs staring at them, you know, the participation in that whole, you know, experience is something that, you know, companies need to get their head around as well. And I didn't find a lot of insight that had to do with that.
I think that was one of the things that I was lacking, I found too. But I don't think it, I don't think that the purpose of the article was to delve into that area, right? So, but I thought that was, I was like, oh, that's it. You know, it was just like number 5 was so short, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and so a perfect follow-up would be, you know, the 10 harsh truths that you're going to have to address in 2020 or 2015 or even next year, right? What are those harsh truths going to be?
Exactly.
Some of these harsh truths will still be around, but there's probably going to be 5 that just fade away because we figured out the CMS or whatever, right? Everybody gets how that works. So mm-hmm. we can cross that one off, but there's going to be there's going to be new ones. You know, how do you deal with the cloud? How do you deal with social media? I'm just making these up, but I'm sure if we could look ahead, there's going to be lots of new problems that we're going to have to address.
And I think they're already emerging, right? I think they're already there and it didn't really address it. Although, you know, that may be, again, like Carl, like you were saying, well, I think this, you know, if you're a smaller organization, it still might be very pertinent, right? And, you know, that's, it depends on the size perhaps of where you're working and what you're doing and so on and so forth. And if you're an innovation company or not as well, I think that's very appropriate too.
Yep, that sounds like it's certainly an area that anybody would want to read this article because it has lots of insight for today. And you're right that we need a new one, that somebody, an idea for somebody to go write one that talks about sort of insights, the harsh truths about you know, moving forward in the space of corporate websites as well. So that was that one. Maybe turn to Elian in terms of items that you lined up for us to talk about today.
I was doing some research into the blue spruce because I thought, for me, that was really a very interesting subject. So I did bookmark a little article about blue spruce and from Technology and Review, which MIT publishes. And I came across, they have a little They've got top 10 new technologies or technologies to look at in 2009. And one of them, which I thought was really interesting, was called Intelligent Software Assistant. And I also read today in the New York Times that Microsoft has come out with something that's similar, but I won't go there. I'll just talk about this one. So basically, the idea here is to build this kind of artificial intelligence, intelligent software that can be that acts as your assistant. So it kind of and it gives a very good example of it. So if you type in, let's say, what to do on Friday, what can I do this weekend? And the software, the program will actually, it's an intelligent software. So, well, okay, these are my variables. It's going to be really nice in San Francisco. I know that you like music and there's a festival going on because you've put in the parameters, right? You've got to put the parameters of your person into the software and then it will respond to your personality traits. I thought that was fascinating. So let's say you do ask that question, what can I do this weekend? It will look at your parameters, look at your profile. It's a profiling software for sure. And then it will say, well, why don't you go see the music festival? And there's two festivals that are going on. It's like a 5-hour drive, but I think you'll really enjoy it. And it's re talking to you in the first person, which was like, wow, that's awesome. And then it can delve deeper. And it's a great article by showing, okay, this is new ways of actually interacting with the person, right? Your computer, this server, wherever it sits, this piece of software, whatever it is actually interacting with you as an individual. It's like your own personal assistant. And Microsoft is actually delving into that with a program called LoRA. And there's an article that was posted as well on it. But I thought that was really a really interesting article in there.
I find that there's a lot of companies looking at this overall space of, where does search go next? I mean, Google has been hugely successful with search, AdWords and everything, all the advertising around search. That is its fundamental, business engine. And then they can, so everybody's now looking at, that model and saying, okay, well, if that's where all the money is, what can we do to improve search? And, companies like Yahoo, companies like Google, and everybody else is actually looking at ways of improving that. I think this is a very good example of one. I find it interesting that as you were giving those examples, Elian, that what I've seen people do, not with sheer search, but using Twitter, is actually ask the same thing. So, I'm going to San Francisco tomorrow. I've got, 3 hours to go do something, or I'm thinking of, going to dinner and I want to have a vegetarian restaurant or whatever, whatever. And, what recommendations do you have? I've been noticing that people are using Twitter really successfully that way as a way of actually linking to sort of the collective knowledge of everybody that you're following, as opposed to it being an automated kind of, search or software assistant technology. So it'd be interesting to see where all this goes in terms of just the straight, search capability that you also have some context for, which is really what this is, right? Context sort of based search or semantic sort of based search, whereas, some of the other social networking capabilities are kind of addressing the same kind of thing, but directly connecting to human beings too. Kind of an interesting new direction.
Yeah, and I think a few podcasts ago we did talk about other ways of searching, and one of them was Mozilla Labs came out with Ubiquiti, right? The text entry field, and you just type it in and it comes out with something. I think, and I exactly, I think they're really moving towards that direction, instead of they're moving away from the whole searching in Google, right? Which is fascinating. I'm like, wow, what's gonna come out next, right?
Right, yeah, and I think it'll tie into some of the cloud things, because it really is amazing now that I can search for all this information. I can find the different hotels, I can find the restaurants, I can book online, but it's still me, crossing a lot of these internal boundaries. So it could be a 10-step process. I see this as trying to tie that in, so that from a user's perspective, they're just, finding something to do in San Francisco. And again, it doesn't really matter if that restaurant has its own website that the system books it in, or whether it uses some third-party website. From the user's perspective, they had a need. They needed to do something fun in San Francisco, get a place to eat. Their goal was satisfied, and well, we'll just call it the magic cloud or whatever, right? Mm-hmm. took care of all of those details. So I definitely see that as the next level. We can build upon search. We can build upon all this great information that we have. We need to build some platforms like Blue Spruce to help people put those pieces together. We definitely need to tie in the social aspect, Carl, because part of that will be, you know, not just querying a database on what the best restaurants are, but, you know, use the social network and being able to, you know, send out quick little pings and just have that be another part of the equation.
Right, because I think people really do rely on reviews as well. You know, it's not just the tweet. It's like, well, how do I know it's good, right? I want to be able to review it,
mm-hmm.
and listen to what people say about it. Like, you know, oh, this has got great reviews, 49 amazing reviews, right? So.
Okay, and just the other part, Eliane, it was really hard for you when you described it. You were describing it in the first person, right, making it really sound personal. But one of the things that's a little bit different from this article, if you read it on the first page, they make comments like, you know what, we just want this to be a good experience. We're not really into the part of simulating human behavior, right? So my guess is that, you know, this could evolve into something that's just like really easy to use. If it happens to sort of feel like a human being, they'll do it. But I think past assumptions where we're building an artificial intelligence, it has to be like Data in Star Trek. It has to be like a human being talking to you. When this one, at least, they seem to be more practical and saying, well, we're not trying to simulate like an actual travel agent. We just want you to be able to find a restaurant in San Francisco.
Right, right. And Laura, the one that Microsoft is building, is actually that Laura is a person, right? It's simulating the... It's simulating someone, which is a completely different take on it.
And of course, right. That's been around too in the in support for some time, right? The whole notion of having this little avatar that is the person that you speak with, and of course, phone systems have that too. And my own experience with them has not been all that positive. I mean, it strikes me as a way of, you know, not having to have people employed doing it, but actually having machines do it. And I find that some of the time they're really effective, but a lot of the time it's sort of like, oh, you know, get out of my way and, you know, let me talk to a real, you know, human being too. So, but I think the point of a lot of the directions that we're talking about here is that there were things, you know, some years ago that were in the research labs at the universities in terms of interaction and technology and human computer interaction. And we're just starting to now see a lot of these things come to the fore that are starting to mature, right? You know, where we've got things like we've talked many times in the past of, you know, multi-touch interfaces and gesture interfaces and using speech, you know, in our artificial intelligence. You know, all of those things have been fascinating academic topics for many years. And what's really kind of exciting about living right at this point of history is that a lot of these things are really becoming mature enough to really be effective, right? And I think that what we're going to see over the next short while is dramatic improvements in some of these areas. And as we were just talking about before too, like this Blue Spruce project at IBM, this sort of integration of all of these things together as well, driving forward. And so, no, I know there was one other article that, Keith, you had also bookmarked that we wanted to talk about before we finished up today.
Yeah, that was Microsoft's glimpse of the future from CNET News. And so what struck me was it's covering some of the same topics that we've been talking about. But what struck me was that just at least from this one article, they kind of had a little like almost like a TV commercial that you could watch that showed, you know, all of this cool interaction design, these integrated systems where, you know, you could be checking your medical records here and there. So there are lots of little quick snippets, but it just sort of left me, you know, I don't know, just sort of really disappointed because this is... It's really just like a quick thing, but for me, when you're talking about the future, I mean, this is when I want to get out a bowl of popcorn and I want to sit down and experience it more like a movie, right? I want it to be more of a scenario and not just a bunch of snippets of different technology back to back to back. Mm-hmm. So that's what sort of struck me here. I'm glad that Microsoft is putting these different pieces together. I think it represents like lots of different projects, and they're trying to get them to fit together. But the delivery mechanism is like this TV commercial just, you know, was blah for me.
I found actually that it, I really loved the production value of it. And I thought it was interesting that you described it as sort of this television commercial. I thought there were a few vignettes that I thought were interesting, you know, a lot of touch, a lot of, you know, interactive paper. There's some really cool technology in there and some level of context setting, at least, although it wasn't all tied together, as you say, you know, Keith. But I'm, you know, my reaction to the piece, beyond saying it's really nice, you know, piece of video, was that, and it's obviously very well done, lots of production value in it, but I remember that we always used to, most companies would create these sort of pictures of the future. What's the user interface of the future going to look like, you know? And that was around the time when, you know, none of those things had really been around yet. You know, we would paint some, you know, real visionary directions, and virtually all companies created those, I mean, of the bigger companies. But I'm wondering, as we talked about earlier in this session, we're talking about things like, you know, the agile development approach, the notion of just, you know, building something and then letting people, you know, see it, or even being really quiet about it, you know, as in Apple tends to not reveal a lot, but then comes out with products that are quite, you know, amazing, and then change the overall sort of experience and the ways in which people deal with technology, you know, after that, you know, launch. And so I'm just wondering whether times have changed in terms of painting the picture of the future, that, you know, rather than doing a video that characterizes what the future might look like, and a lot of the technologies are actually in this one, you know, companies like Apple have been, you know, creating and actually sort of delivering on. I'm wondering if we're in a model now and kind of an overall, you know, approach to doing these things where the market, you know, really is more looking for sort of demonstration technologies that they can go ahead and use, rather than just having, you know, video sort of paintings of what the future, you know, might look like as well. So, I mean, I still thought it was an interesting piece, that it was thought-provoking in some ways, but I just found like it felt like the old way to do this.
Well, I thought it was an advertisement, and it was kind of, you know, Star Trek-ish. Well, this is, doesn't exist, but it's, you know, it's almost like a, you know, I thought it was a novella, let's say, that it's not there, but hey, wouldn't it look cool, you know? So I that's what struck me right away. It's like, and I was like, well, this is, it's not yet, but it's going to be there. And I was like, well, when, right? And I guess the same thing. I was like, well, why show it if it's not created? Just wait until it's actually, you know, it, you have something, and then release it and have people try it, right? Because people like to try stuff now more and more, right? We like to interact with our mobile devices, you know, with our apps, our cloud apps. We, you know, it's kind of touchy-feely, so to speak.
Yeah, it strikes me that we are in sort of a new time. But what's neat about this as well, just in the way of wrapping up as well, when you look at the things that have happened kind of in the last month here, and the trajectory that we're really on with regard to user experience design across a number of different sort of technology areas, this is an incredibly exciting time to be alive and be in the topic areas that we're in. And no matter what company we're talking about here with regard to some of this, I think we're really now in a direction and going down a set of enhancements that really, I think, will yield significant benefits in the future in terms of the way that we're going. And we will pick up in subsequent sessions of this, you know, discussion panel session as well in this podcast series, what happens in the months to come. But I think this one was, again, another instance of some really interesting stuff. We'll have the pointers, the links to the things that we've talked about during this session available on the UXDesignCast.com site. We also have links to this podcast and its replay on ibm.com/design. And of course, the podcast itself and all of its episodes and your ability to subscribe to it is available probably most conveniently directly in the iTunes store. So you can just go to iTunes, or if you want to advise anyone else to go and do this as well, just go to iTunes, go into the store, and just go into the search box and key in UX Designcast, and you'll go directly to this session, and then you can then subscribe to it as well. And as we've talked about before, in addition to these monthly panel discussions, we also have design reviews, we have interviews with design leaders from various companies around the globe, and also have design tutorial sessions as well. So that's probably it for the session for today. Would also like to encourage you to, if you're on Twitter, to follow the IBM Design Twitter feed. You can just go to twitter.com/IBM Design, is one word. Or if you're wanting to communicate directly on Twitter, you can just do @IBM Design as well. So that's it for this particular episode. I'd like to thank Eliane for your participation.
Thanks, Carl. That was great.
And Keith for yours as well.
Thanks again. Another good one.
And thanks so much for all of you for being part of this by listening to this podcast series. And we'll talk to you all next time. And bye for now.